A United States Army field hospital somewhere near the front lines.
Check this place out. See what the nurses are like.
That one, the sultry bitch with the fire in her eyes.
Onward, Christian soldiers, marching as to war.
Who are those men? Friends of yours, in your heart?
I think you will find these accommodating. They're quite dry.
Don't you use olives?
We do have to make certain concessions to the war. We're 3 miles from the front line.
This is the story of two indispensable military surgeons. They had the army over a barrel. But did they take advantage of it? Yes. MASH, a motion picture that raises some important moral questions. And then it drops them.
What are you two hooligans doing in this hospital?
Well, what's the matter with her today?
Look, Mother, I want to go to work in 1 hour. We are the pros from Dover.
Somebody get that dirty old man out of this operating theater.
And then give me at least one nurse who knows how to work in close without getting her tits in my way.
I wonder how a degenerated person like that could have reached a position of responsibility in the Army Medical Corps.
He was drafted.
Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come.
His will be done.
Oh, Frank, my lips are hot. Kiss my heart, Glenn.
We have got to share this with the rest of the
Frank. Frank.
What the hell is that?
Frank.
I should check with the military vicar's office. You see, I cannot give absolution to a man who is about to commit suicide.
You have any particular method that you'd recommend?
Black capsule.
Suicide is painless. It brings on many changes.
This isn't a hospital! It's an insane asylum!
Welcome to the Film and Water Podcast, proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Rob Kelly, and this is a really special episode. I have had both these gentlemen on the show previously, but not together. But now they're both here to talk about MASH, Robert Altman's classic 1970 movie. From the Movie Film Podcast, we have Zaki Hassan and Brian Hall. Gentlemen, welcome back, both of you, to the show.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, this is really, really cool. Now, I like to refer to you guys as the Power Man and Iron Fist of podcasting because you're a great duo. Now, normally, of course, we're talking about MASH. You think I would refer to you as the Hawkeye and Trapper of podcasting. But if I do that, then that means I am either Frank Burns or Duke Forrest. And I don't want to be either one of those guys. So we're going to have to live with Power Man and Iron Fist for now.
I was going to say, maybe we're the Hot Lips and Frank of podcasting. I don't know.
The reason we're here to talk about this movie, other than the fact that I love it, and as anyone knows who has known me for any length period of time, I love MASH, the TV show. It is my favorite show of all time. I grew up on it. I've never not watched it. It is the only thing remaining in my sort of podcast oeuvre that I haven't done a show on yet. I want to do a MASH podcast. I just don't have the time. But I love the show so completely. And I didn't see the movie till later on. And as we'll get to it, if you were only familiar with the TV show, seeing the movie is a bit of a shock because there's a lot of differences between the movie and the TV show. Now, the reason we start all this is that you guys talked about it on a previous movie film. Now, Brian, you're like me, right? You just saw the movie recently, correct?
Yeah, I had, very similar to you, actually, I grew up watching the show, and I'm not, like, intimately familiar with it, but it was something that I watched at night with my dad when I was younger, before I would go to bed, because it was usually syndicated at, like, 10 at night or something. So I knew the characters, I had an affection for it, and I actually remember back in the day, my dad being like, eh, don't watch the movie. And I was like, all right. Like it just meant nothing to me. I was like, all right, well, no interest in the movie. It must not. They must have taken a concept and turned it into something more enjoyable. And then all these years later, you know, that I learned about films and Robert Altman and whatnot, I'm like, oh, well, kind of curious what this movie is, actually. And then just some random night on HBO, it was playing. And I was like, oh, I think it's time. And so, yeah, like exactly like you said. So then I just watched it as it began and was completely taken aback by how different it was in tone and somewhat in style from the show I was familiar with.
Well, Zachy, it's the opposite for you, right? You saw the movie first.
I did. My experience with MASH is I was never not aware of it because I don't think growing up in the 80s and 90s you could not be aware of MASH, you know, because it was such a cultural force. But it was just something that was not part of my direct experience, so I just never got around to watching it. And then in 2006, they released the complete series set on DVD,
right?
And that included the film. And so I was at a phase of my life where I would just buy any DVD collector set. I had more disposable income at that time. And I was like, all right, sure. And so I bought it, and I happened to buy it, you know, just a few weeks before my first son was born. And so shortly after he was born, you know, I would just be up late with him. And so I was like, well, I got this. I got all these hours of DVD. And this is, you know, this is before Netflix and things like that, right? There was no binge watching,
right?
Through streaming, you know. So I was like, well, I need something. I need content. So I watched the movie first. I just went in release order. So my context of the film was not being intimately aware of the show, but still having a general sense of it, but still, in essence, this movie being my first awareness to that universe, and then going directly into the show. So that contrast was very pronounced and very immediate.
Yeah, this movie, as said, is a real slap in the face if you're only familiar with the show, because mm-hmm. it's, I mean, the characters are meaner. Mm-hmm. It's the humor is pretty raw. I mean, this movie was rated R. The interactions are similar in that you've got Hawkeye, played here by Donald Sutherland, Trapper John, played by Elliot Gould, Frank Burns is Robert Duvall. Robert Duvall, man, that guy has been in everything. It was just like
I was thinking that, yeah, because I worked on a movie that he was in, and so I've sort of, you know, maybe shook his hand and said hello or something like that.
Wow, you actually met him?
Yeah, I mean, very. I was like a PA on that movie, so I probably had to hand him something.
Wow.
But I mean, it was. I had a moment when I was watching this movie because I didn't know he was in it, and I was like, "Man, this guy's been in everything!" And like, how far back he goes, and what a storied career! And it was just sort of cool seeing him in this classic. Everywhere. I know that's an understatement. Everybody knows he's in these classics, but it was just sort of a weird personal touch for me.
It's, I mean, considering all the movies he's been in that he's famous for, The Godfather or even, like, right. To Kill a yeah. Mockingbird, you forget he's not, MASH is not, like, one of, like, the first 20 movies that's mentioned that he's starred
yeah,
in. And
yeah.
yet this movie's, you know, considered a classic, and there he is. And he's playing an iconic character. He's playing Frank Burns, which nowadays, you know, everyone is familiar with the Frank Burns archetype because we're living in that world at the moment. So
right.
Frank Burns has come roaring back. What do you guys both like the movie? I mean, like, I think it's a classic, but it's one of the things I loved about the TV show is that even though you would never want to be there because they're 3 miles from the front and they're dealing with war and it's blood and guts, you still, I don't know, to me, there's the familial comfort of the MASH mm-hmm. unit. I mean, I would want to hang out with Alan Alda as Hawkeye. I'd want to hang out with B.J. Honeycutt. I don't know if I want to hang out with this group. These are kind of mean people.
Yeah, these are guys that I'm certain are talking behind my back. In the film, watching the film, I didn't know how I felt about it afterwards. And it's funny because Zachy and I sometimes, just the nature of things, he'll see a movie early, like a press screening, and I'll have to go see it like right away when it comes out, and we'll talk about it sometimes almost immediately after I've watched it. And it's interesting having an initial reaction to something, but then maybe even the next day I'll change my mind. Like something that I thought was stupid, I'm like, oh, actually I get what they were going for there, or vice versa. And I found that was my reaction with this movie. I had an initial immediate reaction where I was a little, I didn't dislike it, but I was a little put off by it, and I wanted to process it. And I found myself doing a deep dive on the internet, you know, reading about the making of and people's think pieces on it and whatnot. And I found that through that process, I really came to appreciate it.
Yeah, I think it's, I mean, it's it for people who haven't seen it yet, the format is completely like genre busting in that Robert Altman, this movie doesn't tell any chronological story. It's really just, we see Hawkeye and Duke Forrest, played by Tom Skerritt, arrive at the 477. And that sort of starts the story. But after that, it's really just a series of vignettes that are told in some sort of loose chronological order. But there's really no plot. And the overlapping dialogue is, I mean, it still seems fresh to me now, even though there's been dozens or hundreds maybe of movies made like that since. It's still, I can't imagine what this must have been like seeing it in 1970, because there was just nothing else like it.
And I didn't, in doing my deep dives, I didn't realize that it was such a big deal having those graphic surgeries in the film. And apparently the studio wanted them to cut them out, and they were jarring to people because they weren't used to such graphic imagery in films at the time. And it's funny because those do really serve the story. And you realize, you know, they act in these sort of selfish, prankster sort of ways, but it's really them combating the horrors that they are confronted with every day. So it's helpful to see, like, get a glimpse of actually what they have to confront and what they're fighting against, just internally, and just trying to stay sane against.
Oh, yeah, there's that one scene where they bring the body in and you literally see blood spurting out of somebody's portion, and you hear the nurse yell, "Hawkeye!" And he's like, yeah, I'm busy. And she yells it again, and then he turns around and sees it. It's like, that's a...
Right. Yeah.
You know, I think for me, I just rewatched it following, you know, my conversation with Brian, as tends to happen, as Brian is like, "Oh, I rewatched MASH." I was like, "I think I'm going to rewatch MASH because I'm a follower, not a leader." And and so, you know, it was nice to revisit it with you know, 10 years of distance. Actually, the one time I watched it in the middle was I screened it for one of my film classes, and at the end of the semester, I asked them, you know, which was the favorite film that we watched, which is your least favorite. Overwhelmingly, MASH was the least favorite.
Huh.
And so I was like, okay, I'm not going to screen that again. And I think the reason that it was their least favorite was because, as you said, Rob, it's not an experience that you really have a framework for going into it. And so it is one of those things that really does. You have to let it grow on you like a wart a little bit. You know, but I for me, you know, I mean, having seen it a few times, I like the fact that it really does seem ahead of its time, because I think if a movie like that were to come out today, nobody would bat an eye because I think Altman was anticipating the zeitgeist a little bit. What's also interesting is that it came out right around the same time as the movie Catch 22, which I don't know if you've seen that. But they're very, very similar in that they both have a very absurdist view of something very serious, which is, you know, the business of war. You know, and they tackle it from two different perspectives. But they're like kissing cousins, these two movies. Also interesting, Alan Alda is in Catch 22, so kind of random.
Oh, huh.
I forgot that. I've seen that movie. Yeah. I forgot that he's in that movie. Wow. Oh, yeah. I mean, part of the way that Altman was able to get this movie made, and he has said in interviews in the years since, is that this movie was made for such little money, and Fox was spending all of its time worrying about Patton, which was being made at the same time, that literally nobody was paying attention to what he was doing. And they really just didn't pay attention to Altman at all. And that's how he was able to sort of get this movie made, of just this overlapping dialogue. And, you know, the opening scene where, again, it's Hawkeye and Duke Forrest meet, the only bit of studio meddling is in that opening scene where there's a scrawl talking about that this is Korea. And that was the thing that Altman wanted to leave out, because he wanted to, obviously, this is 1970, we're talking about Vietnam without talking about Vietnam. And so, but the studio was like, no, that's too far. You're sticking the scrawl in Korea. And it's in there, and you kind of just see it and you forget it right after that. And then the opening scene is great. It's Sutherland is terrific, and Tom Skerritt, everything is good. They steal the Jeep and they drive into the 477, where we meet Radar, played by Gary Berghoff, who's one of the few actors that would go to the series playing the same character, Roger Bowen playing Colonel Henry Blake. And then the one scene that really, when I first watched this movie, put me off is when they go to the swamp and they meet Frank Burns for the first time. And Frank Burns is teaching Ho-John how to speak English, which is, again, very nice. Now, we get the sense immediately just from the way that Duvall carries himself and just the way he has that kind of stern look on his face that Burns is not going to fit in well with Duke and Hawkeye, because these two guys are proto-hippies, basically. But
right.
But Burns is not a bad guy, and immediately Hawkeye and Duke really kind of like screw him over. And they start making fun of him that he starts to pray, which I always thought, well, that's kind of a dick move.
This goes to a conversation Brian and I have had before where the sort of the cinematic trope of the evil religious guy.
Right.
Yeah.
And this, I feel like the seed of that trope is Frank Burns in the film. Because certainly what we see of him later on justifies him being the villain of the piece.
Yep.
But him merely being religious and then being kind of – and Hawkeye and Duke kind of rolling their eyes at the mere fact that he pulls out a Bible is something for me where I'm like, well, geez. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing inherently wrong with that. So that there's a little bit of the filmmaker bias creeping through there, in my opinion.
That was the moment where, because you can start movies with anti-heroes and they steal the Jeep, and it may as well be like Bradley Cooper being cheeky these days in some sort of movie right. or something. But yeah, their immediate hateful reaction to this person in the tent, that was really what sort of, I was like, oh, what? I don't get this film. You know, like these people are, well, because, and again, with reference with the television show, that wasn't the characters that I remember, but here they were just straight hateful. And that was like, oh, I am in for a different experience characters.
I suppose what you could say is that he's teaching Ho-John to read, which is fine. But by teaching him the Bible, he's essentially forcing his beliefs onto him.
Sure.
And maybe that's what Hawkeye and Duke are responding to.
Yeah. I think it was like, they just sort of walk in with this swagger that everyone else is beneath them. And, like, this guy is different than me, and, like, let's make his life hell. And that's what they seem to do throughout the movie, too. Like, even when there's that portion when they travel to Japan.
Yeah.
And they just sort of, like, expect to just kick through the doors and everyone to let them do whatever they want, behave however they want, and then they're going to leave however they want. And it's just this funny, cocky, sort of off-putting attitude that they have that – I say off-putting as I was watching it for the first time, but then when I take a step back, I can appreciate the characterizations.
Yeah, I think it's the kind of thing where you can get away with it in a movie, but if you had to deal with these people in real life, you would hate their guts. You would be like, oh, my God. And I agree entirely, Zachy, about that. The only thing about Frank Burns that we learn in the beginning is that he's very religious. Well, you don't have to be a dick to him about it. Now, later on, there's this scene where Frank basically blames the death of a patient on one of the orderlies played by Bud Cort, who of course would go on to be in like a dozen Robert Altman movies, and he blames this kid when it's clearly not his fault. And you see the poor kid, I think he's Boone, I think he's Bud Cort is playing, and you see him start to cry because he doesn't know enough to know that Burns is being ridiculous, and Duvall is great in that moment because he's just such an asshole where he's like, forget it, Boone, you killed him. And he throws the needle down, and it's Trapper that sees that. And, of course, Trapper takes Burns into a side room and punches him out right as Hot Lips is walking in for the first time. So later on, we do see that Burns is as bad as we think he is. But in that opening scene, it's like it really isn't earned. And that was very jarring for me coming from the show where – Burns deserves all of the shit that he gets from the guys, because in the show, there's no religious angle, really. Burns is a fake religion. He carries a Bible with him sometimes, but it's totally fake. The Larry Linville Frank Burns is a fake patriot, a crook, a bad doctor, and but he pretends to be all the opposite of all those things, and so you completely justified hating his guts. But you get the context for it. It's the opening in this movie. You're just a little like, wow, these guys just come in and just take over the place. And then they go in to Henry's office and they demand that Burns be kicked out of their tent.
Right, right.
and even Henry Blake is like, your tent, you know, like whatever. And then, of course, he acquiesces to it because that's what Henry was, basically. Just kind of go along to get along kind of guy.
He's a rubber stamp.
Yeah, he's a rubber stamp. And we get to see the the building blocks of the relationship between Henry and Radar, and the whole double talk, and the fact that Radar is one step ahead of everybody. I like the other angle in this movie, that you have the other character. I forget his name. I think it's Vollmer, who wants to be Radar, but he's not Radar. Like, he's always trying to curry favor with Henry, but Radar is the one who's got it. You know, Radar's got it all going on, and Vollmer is constantly like, wait, what? What did you say? Radar's off doing the job before Vollmer even has his pants on, basically. That's like a funny little angle that was not reproduced in the show.
Yeah, and it was funny seeing Radar played by the same actor. It was like this nice little connection.
Right, Gary Berghoff is the only main actor that went from the movie to the show. We skipped ahead a little, and that the movie opens with this wonderful song, Suicide is Painless, and it was written by Robert Altman's son, Mike Altman. And I read this a little bit, and it confuses me, is that Robert Altman basically asked Johnny Mandel, who wrote the tune, to write the song, and he said, I want the stupidest song imaginable. And Johnny Mandel wrote the tune, and then his son, Mike Altman, wrote the lyrics. I don't understand that. I think Suicide is Painless is a great song. Am I crazy?
I wonder if it's because I was surprised to see it in the film actually being sung by a character. And maybe it was supposed to be like, oh, some guy made this up on the spot. You know what I mean?
Well, maybe,
some soldier wrote this in this scene that's actually supposed to be somewhat silly. And so it's a non-songwriter's take on what a serious song would sound like.
Oh, maybe.
Well, that was a lot to say. Sassel.
But, I mean, I think that the opening theme, like the opening footage with the theme, I think it's really beautiful. Like, I find that song, I don't know, I love it. I don't, and maybe you're right, Brian. Maybe that was Altman's point of view. And the one little piece of trivia that I love about that song is that because Mike Altman wrote the lyrics, he gets credit and he gets money for the show, because the show, of course, used it as a theme. So Mike Altman has made more money off MASH the movie than his father ever did.
Oh, how funny. Well, you can also see why they didn't use the lyrics on the TV show.
That's right.
Yeah.
Singing about how suicide is painless, probably not going to play in prime time.
But to your point, Rob, it's interesting at the beginning that we do hear that song and we don't question it. Like, it doesn't seem silly to us, like you were saying.
Yeah, I think it's I think it's a beautiful opening.
But is that partially because you already know the tune from the show?
That's a good point.
That's got to be part of it. It's my favorite TV theme outside of like the Rockford Files or something, because I just think it fits the setting of the tone. So, and we see a little bit of that Altman improvisation, and that in the opening scene we see an orderly, as he's pulling a body off the chopper, fall over into the mud. And that wasn't supposed to happen, and Altman just left it in.
Oh, funny.
Yeah, he just thought he left it in because it was like, it's fine. It was fine the way it is. So, now, apparently, Donald Sutherland and Elliot Gould did not get along with Robert Altman in the beginning, and they went to the studio to try to get him fired.
Wow.
Yeah, isn't that fascinating?
and it didn't work, obviously. And then later on, after the movie proved to be such a hit, Gould apologized to Robert Altman, which is why Gould ended up being in a bunch of Robert Altman movies, and Donald Sutherland never did, which is why Donald Sutherland never worked with Robert Altman again.
That's so funny. It's always hard to imagine. I mean, I think about this a lot. Actually, I talk about this on the podcast a lot. I have this weird fascination with stories where you already know the outcome, where it's like, and the guy made $1 billion. Like, we know that. Right. But then when you go and read the oral histories or the biographies or the whatever, and you see all the opposition they had, and they're making a decision that hadn't been made before. And I think, man, would I have done that? Like, I don't know if I would have gotten to that outcome. And it's the confidence in creative people to try something new and to have his two lead actors conspiring against him because of these things, but him sticking to his guns and then creating something that we're still talking about, you know, X amount of years later. I admire that boldness.
Yeah, it was a massive hit. I mean, the movie was – it ended up being re-released on a double bill with Patton, which is – talk about the alpha and omega of approaches to war.
Man, Patton itself is a double bill. That's such a long movie.
Yeah. For a long night at the movies. They talked about MASH a couple of months ago on the Next Picture Show. And when they paired it up, I think, with Whiskey Tango Foxtrot. And the four hosts, two of them are women, and the two women had never seen MASH before. And they really didn't like it. They did not this movie at all because they thought it was sexist and it was racist. And they just couldn't get past that. Tasha Robinson, I was blanking on the host. Tasha Robinson is one of the hosts. And they just flat out did not like MASH at all because of what they perceived as incredibly retrograde attitudes. Does that, I don't know, does that bother you guys?
I think the sexist, I'm more on the fence about the racism, at least insofar as intent. I think sexism, it's there's no doubt. I mean, I said this when talking to Brian earlier. I mean, I think the way Hot Lips O'Houlihan in the film is treated is awful, you know? I mean, it makes me uncomfortable, you know? And she's a character you're not necessarily supposed to like, but I mean, that's kind of, you know, you talk about contrasts with the show. I mean, by the end of the show, you really like Hot Lips.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And she's not Hot Lips. She's Margaret, you know, by the end of the show.
Right. It's derogatory to refer to her like that at a certain point.
Yeah. Whereas the film, I mean, there's the scene where, you know, they set up the whole prank because they want to see what she looks like naked, basically, right? So they set up this whole thing, and then everybody's standing around watching. That's awful. But that's awful enough. But then she runs into Colonel Blake's tent, and she's weeping. I mean, she's not, like, it's not comical. It's tragic the way she's like, please, do you allow them to do this? And Colonel Blake, who in the clearest instance of how this Colonel Blake is so different from McClane Stevenson's version, he's like, he completely blows her off. I forget exactly what he says, but
she says, if you don't do something, I'm going to resign my commission. And he says, well, then resign your goddamn commission.
Yeah. And I mean, you watch that and it's like, I don't know, if you're a person, you're like, well, that's the type of thing where, like, you can't, you know, to your earlier point, Hawkeye and Trapper on the show would never go that far to the point of just reducing Margaret to just like a weeping mess, you know?
Right. Like traumatizing her. for the camp's entertainment.
Exactly.
Isn't it amazing to think that you know, somebody would look at the content of this movie, which was so filthy and so nasty, and say, this would make a good TV show.
Yeah. It's one of those unique instances, though, where the softening of it, I mean, maybe that's not the best word, but whatever they did, how they transformed it, actually worked, right? Yes. And they still were able to make a show that had a point of view, and the characters were, you know, tweaked but still worked. It's how rare is that? I mean, instead of just turning it into an out goofball comedy or something, or I don't know, it feels like the spirit of it is still there, but they just found a way to make it a little more agreeable to an audience or something.
It should not have worked. I mean, when you talk about turning a successful film into a TV show, I mean, I think MASH at the time was without precedent in terms of the longevity it had, and I think it's still without antecedent. I can't think of another example of a film to TV translation that's had the cultural footprint that the MASH TV show did. It shouldn't have worked, but I think it's the differences between them that made it work. I mean, Altman was not a fan of the show, which you can totally see why, because he probably felt like they took his framework and essentially strip mined it, you know, for sort of public consumption. But I mean, I think all the ways that they changed it are why it's still remembered.
I will say this about Robert Altman's not liking of the show, because on the audio commentary that he does for the movie, he really bashes the show. And okay, I could see like what you're saying, Zaki. They took his thing and did something very different with it, and so maybe it's a kind of like, the reason Stephen King doesn't like The Shining is the Stephen King just can't get over what his version is versus
right.
what
yeah, and
did.
And Rob, you know, another example, Rob, is Roland Emmerich and Dean Devlin hated Stargate SG-1.
Okay.
You know, so I think it's just you're the person who created this thing, and then somebody else takes it and does something different with it. I think it's very difficult to separate your investment, your emotional capital that you have in it, with whatever somebody else does, especially when it becomes successful, right? Because then it's like, this thing is a success without me.
You're right. right. The one little bit though that I never forgot, and it sort of soured me on Robert Altman permanently, not seeing his movies, because his movies were terrific, very much up until the end, But when he, at one point during the audio commentary, he talks about the show and he goes, that show starring, Alan Ackerman or whatever his name is. I'm like, oh, you know his name's Alan Alda, yeah. Robert Altman. Stop it. Like, stop being so goddamn too cool for school. You know it's Alan Alda. Stop it. That pissed me off.
Yeah. That's yeah.
Come on, Robert. That's ridiculous. Now,
I wonder if he held a grudge against Gary Berghoff. Like, I wonder if they ever fought that and it was awkward, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. Some of the other actors from the movie did make it into the show. The G. Wood, who plays the general, who they compete against in the football game, he was on the first six episodes of MASH, playing basically the same character, and then they phased him out because of the generals kept changing. But yeah, Gary Berghoff is the only one to stay. And it's funny, if you watch the really early MASHes, the first five or six episodes,
I just did in the past week.
So. Oh, really? Yeah, season one. They're trying to replicate the kind of big gang that you see in the movie, and that there's the one where Henry, it's called the Henry Please Come Home, where Henry is sent to Tokyo, and Frank gets to take over. You see the hangers-on around Hawkeye and Trapper and Red. There's like four or five other guys, and they're all kind of
Spear
unnamed.
Chucker.
Yeah, there's Spearchucker, and there's Boone. There's all these unnamed people, and they're they're reproducing the movie characters, and I guess the show realized we don't need all these people. We can just have Hawkeye, Trapper, and Radar. We don't need, you know, all these, like Bruno Kirby. Bruno, big time star Bruno Kirby plays Boone in the MASH pilot. He's never seen again, but there he is. So yeah, you could see them trying to figure out how much of the movie do we need to retain. I mean, they have Ho-John is in the show in the early
episodes. Pretty soon they realized they didn't need Trapper either. So.
Right. Well, it's interesting in that in the movie, Trapper John is played by Elliot Gould, is ostensibly the main character. Once he shows up, he really kind of takes the movie over from Hawkeye a bit, in my estimation.
That is true.
And in the show, it was completely opposite. I mean, Alan Alda just dominated the show. I mean, Elliot Gould, it's hard to remember, you know, nowadays that Elliot Gould is Elliot Gould, but like Elliot Gould was a huge movie star in the 70s. And
he's Ross and Rachel's dad.
Right. he's Mr. Geller, right? But I love him in this movie. I think I love him as Trapper John.
Oh, he's terrific. I agree. Brian and I on our last episode were talking about Trapper John MD, the TV series. And what's kind of interesting is that that film is, and this is like legal nonsense maybe because it doesn't really matter, but the film is, the TV show, Trapper John MD, is meant to be a sequel to MASH the movie, not MASH the TV series.
Oh, man.
Did you know that?
Try explaining that in the days before internet and getting an audience to, have that friend of mine going into it.
So it's such a nothing distinction, honestly, but I think knowing that it's the Elliot Gould character who winds up being, you know, head of surgery or whatever.
It's a big Purnell Roberts.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. So this movie, the good chunk of this movie, too, at the end is this whole thing with the football game. And
which is kind of interminable, to be honest, because just rewatching it, I'm like, okay, let's cut to the chase here, you know, because it sort of feels like they were running out the clock a little bit.
Well, I was just about to ask you guys that, because I feel like, doesn't this football game go on a little long? It's like, it's like 25 minutes out of a two-hour movie. I'm like, at what point are we doing MASH anymore and we're just doing North Dallas 40 here? What's going on?
Yeah, that was jarring, honestly. Yeah, the first time. Well, I mean, and this is a bunch of, it's almost like an anthology movie, just sort of this thing happens and then this thing happens and this thing happens.
It's episodic.
Yeah, it's episodic. That's a better word. And so, yeah, when you get to the football game, I know they sort of pepper it throughout, right? Talking about a football team, but it wasn't like the big game's coming up and we got to get together. There's some sort of, you know, stakes in this. It's just we get dropped into another thing that they participate in that we don't necessarily have any stakes in other than our heroes are playing in a competition for something. And then it's funny for me, I was really surprised by Hot Lips during the scene, how she's completely converted to the cult of,
to make an allusion to another Donald Sutherland movie, she's become one of the pod people.
right. Like these people, that have just completely mortified her and treat her like garbage.
She's broke her down. And
She's like this maniac cheerleader on the sidelines to the point where she can't even do that without like the coach or someone else being like, shut up, you idiot. You know, kind
blithering
of
idiot. Yeah. Colonel Blank says that.
Yeah.
Right, because they shoot, they fire the gun off, and she says, "Oh my God, they've shot him." And Henry says, "Hot lips, you nincompoop, it's the end of the quarter." I mean, it's like, oh, okay. Yeah, she becomes Duke Forrest's girlfriend at a certain point. Because there's a scene where they're playing poker, and she's just sitting on his lap. So she's, as you're right, she's completely converted. Once they get rid of Burns in kind of a really mean way, because the prank they pull is they stick a microphone in a tent when Burns and Hot Lips are having sex. They broadcast it across the camp over the loudspeakers, and that
which, by the way, I love Father Mulcahy's reaction.
Yes.
It cracks me up when he's hearing it. He's trying to figure out what it is.
Oh, right. He hears the, he thinks
it's a radio show.
Yeah, the Battling Bickersons. He's like, I love this show. And then,
when he realizes how he's like, I gotta go.
You know, it's funny. This is a little non sequitur, but speaking of Father Mulcahy, I didn't really realize this until I read up on the movie afterwards, but I really grew to appreciate his character because the characters in the film, as much as they don't like the quote unquote religious type right off the bat at the beginning, they seem to sort of leave him alone or appreciate that he's a sweet person kind of a thing. So the fact that they're, when he comes in for that broadcast and they're not like, you don't want to be here. They're like, hey, come on in. And I love the fact that he sweetly realizes he's in a situation that's uncomfortable to him, so he removes himself. But then the scene later that I didn't quite get, when he's saying the prayer by the Jeeps at the end of the movie, which I found out was an improvisation by him later that they decided to film. I read later that the prayer he's praying is something that people would pray over chariots before they would enter into battle.
Wow.
And I was like, from someone else's commentary, they're saying he just realized that was the least he could do. Like, that's the way that he could be useful to these people. And I was like, wow, that was – what an interesting character. And, like, what a sweet, subtle – I mean, you have to sort of know what's going on, but what a nice moment for that character.
That's interesting.
He can't necessarily be one of them, and he doesn't know how to be, the camaraderie or whatever, but he finds his way to do the thing that he can to help them. I was like, wow, that's really cool.
Yeah, it's played by he's played by René Auberjonois, another guy who's had an incredible career. I mean, just doing one, he was in Star Trek, and he's in King Kong, Zach. He's in your favorite King Kong movie. So
he was a 70s mainstay.
Yeah, I mean, he's had a really long career. And yeah, you're right, Brian. I always got the sense that it's Mulcahy doesn't, and this is true of the TV show version too, played by William Christopher, who unfortunately just passed away just last year. That he doesn't cotton to what goes on in terms of the shenanigans, but he finds a way to be who he is, but not sort of be in constant conflict with everyone else. Burns doesn't know how to do that. Burns is just going to constantly be butting heads with these people, while Mulcahy is more like, as you said, with that scene where he realizes, oh, I don't want to be here, he just absents himself from it, as opposed to sort of scolding them all. He kind of just is like, okay, this is not my scene, and he leaves, and it works out perfectly. And then of course there's a scene later on where they're in the mess tent, and Hawkeye is talking to Margaret, and he makes that really lewd come on to her about, you know, you should come back to my tent, and she gets disgusted, and he walks away, and she says something like, you know, I don't know how a degenerate like that could become a captain in the Major Army Corps. And then you get Mulcahy, he goes, he was drafted. And it's a gong. Yeah. I mean, they literally do like a drum roll sound effect. Right. But yeah, he's terrific. And this is something else too. And this maybe will be covered if I ever do my MASH podcast. But it's like MASH the show gets a lot of grief from kind of like people on the conservative side of things. That it's, oh, it's liberal claptrap. But I mean, MASH presented 11 straight seasons of a devoutly religious character. And it never once made fun of him for that. Not once did it ever present Mulcahy as anything other than a good guy. You know, so
yeah. And based on what we're saying, I would say almost similarly, and in the film with him.
Yeah, he's a really good. We like Father Mulcahy. He's really
Because he's genuine.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe that's.
You'll note also that in the show, he's not called Dago Red.
No, yeah, they leave that part out. They do leave that part out. One of the things that did get sort of cut up in this movie is there was a missing Hojan plot.
Yeah, I was going to mention that.
Right. Yeah, I read that.
Yeah, Ho-John, we see in this movie, Ho-John is their houseboy. And then we see in the movie, he gets taken in by, I'm not sure who, it's like the Korean army, the South Korean army, because he has high blood pressure. And he gets basically taken away from Hawkeye. And Donald Sutherland has a great moment where he seems genuinely upset that he's not going to see Ho-John again. Because he says something like, damn, you know, and he's like really bothered that Ho-John is going to kind of just disappear. And apparently the movie's plot, we see Ho-John gets wounded and gets brought into surgery. And it's the scene where later on, there's a scene in the film where Radar gets blood from Henry in the middle of the night without telling him. That is for Ho-John. That blood is for Ho-John. But we never see that. We never see that Ho-John gets injured. And then later on, there's even another scene where they're all playing poker and there's a Jeep driving off a body. And we see everyone in the swamp look at the body and not react and go back to their poker game. And you get the sense that, oh, like that's, you know, without that Ho-John scene, you think it's just kind of another soldier that has died. And they're upset, but they're not getting, they don't. They're kind of like not letting it interfere with their game. But that was supposed to be Ho-John. It was the body of Ho-John.
Yeah. I wish they would have left that in, you know.
I kind of like that.
Added some poignancy, yeah.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. I mean, I would, not knowing that it was supposed to be Ho-John, I just took it as, okay, this is just, after the wackiness of the football game, that's that scene. And I guess to me, it's just a reminder of the work goes on. You know, the body, yeah.
I think the idea that they know it's Ho-John, and as a result, like just for their own emotional preservation, they're being deliberately sort of indifferent to this body being taken away. I don't know. To me, that adds a layer of pathos that is kind of missing in the film, you know?
Yeah.
That's just my thought.
I could see that. Yeah. I think it would have been interesting to, I mean, again, they could have cut some football footage for the Ho-John, for the Ho-John plot. I mean, the football game, though, of course, is worth mentioning, features the first F-word in any major motion picture.
I read that.
John Chuck as the painless Paul, the dentist, who, of course, we know is the best-equipped dentist in the Army. He says the F-word, and I could be wrong, because Lord knows I can't trust my memory anymore now that I've gotten old, but I watched this movie on basic TV, like UHF, one night, and I swear to God that they left that word in.
It's possible.
I don't think they said they could say F words even today on UHF, but I swear to God I remembered hearing it and going, did I just hear him say the F word? Like, I was just shocked by it. It was like, oh my God.
Maybe, I mean, now it's, you know, films are just peppered with things and they have to go through and actually do separate recording sessions to change the language, but maybe, I mean, I have no idea, but maybe back then it wasn't such a thing and they slipped past them.
What did you guys think of Tom Skerritt as Duke Forrest? Because he's the biggest difference, I'd say, to the movie and film is that that character is entirely absent from the TV show.
I think that he serves a purpose in that the way the film presents them, they are a triad. And I was thinking, actually, as I was prepping for this, that in many ways it feels to me like Hawkeye on the show is a merger of Hawkeye and Duke in the movie.
How so?
I think Hawkeye in the movie is very glib and very understated, whereas Duke is a little bit more emotional. And I think the Alan Alda Hawkeye is a more emotional person. He's glib, but he's not understated. If we're to make a Hawkeye is very in the film. He's kind of the Mr. Spock almost, if you compare him to Trapper and Duke.
I think
the version of Hawkeye that we got on the show, you know, they had supposedly offered Duke the Duke role to Tom Skerritt to reprise on the show. He didn't want to do it. And so I think with that in mind, they just merged them together and that's what we got on the show. So Duke is not truly, he's not really gone as long as we remember him. Because we get an aspect of him, I think, in TV's Hawkeye. That's just my read.
It's interesting. I never really thought of it that way. I think that this movie features the best way how to handle a racist. Because there's this scene where they talk about that they're going to get Spearchucker, to be the ringer for their football game. And they're talking about, you know, the plot is that we'll hide Spearchucker and then we'll rack up some points and then we'll bet, blah, blah, blah. And Hawkeye and Trapper are all excited over this plot. And Duke Forrest, of course, is from the South, and he's kind of going, well, where's he going to – is he going to fit in? And you're like, well, yeah. we know what Duke Forrest is talking about. And then they say, well, he'll just bunk with us. Because, of course, Trapper and Hawkeye are from the North, you know, and they're just kind of like, oh, he'll just bunk with us. And Skerritt's Duke Forrest is like, you guys are serious, right? And he doesn't want to come out and say it. But he's like, and then he says something like, it's hard enough dealing with you two Yankees. And I love that there's this pause where Trapper and Hawkeye just look at each other and then they just push Duke over. And that's the end of the conversation. I thought that's the most cleanest way to deal with a racist possible. If someone starts talking like that, just push them over and walk away. It's like, I'm just not dealing with this. It's great. Yeah, I mean, Fred Williamson plays Spearchucker Jones, the brain surgeon. Another character reproduced in the TV show very briefly, and then they just phased him out. And then they kind of...
That's a shame, by the way. I wish they would have kept him around on the show. I'm not sure the rationale behind getting rid of him, but I liked the character, what he represents anyway.
They retconned him out, too, because, like, they acted as though he never existed. I mean...
Yeah, he's somewhere with Chuck Cunningham.
Yeah, exactly.
And that Winslow daughter, who nobody remembers anymore.
Yeah, I mean, anytime they would ever refer to Hawkeye's previous bunkmates, Spearchucker was never brought up in later seasons. I was just like, no, it was always just Trapper and Burns. There's no Spearchucker. That never happened. So, I mean, yeah, this movie just sort of rolls along. There's this whole great sequence with where the dentist wants to commit suicide because he can't get it up anymore, and he just wants to kill himself because if he can't perform sexually, what's the point in living? And that's where we, as you mentioned earlier, Brian, where they bring back in Suicide is Painless.
Right.
As brought up by, and you said it sounds like it is like an impromptu song. And I like that version too. I like the kind of guitar-y version. I don't know. I like the song no matter what version they choose to show me.
Yeah. And then knowing then that it's supposed to fit into the narrative is like a somewhat, you know, bad song sung by someone in the film. I remember thinking like, well, it's not that bad.
Yeah,
like, this is actually quite impressive.
Do you guys take that scene to be kind of homophobic, because the dentist goes on a date and he finds that he can't perform sexually, so he then immediately assumes, okay, well, that means I'm gay, and if I'm gay, that means I should just kill myself.
I should just kill myself
because
yeah.
I'm so messed up. And I've seen other people say that it's a very homophobic scene, but I don't know. I always took it as the movie itself recognizes how silly the dentist is being. I mean, the movie isn't advocating the dentist's point of view. It's saying this is how this guy is reacting.
Yeah,
above and beyond that, sorry, Brian. I mean, above and beyond that, it's set in the 50s. I mean, it's set during a time when social views about sexuality were different than they are now. So, I mean, you know, I'm always wary of sort of retroactively condemning a worldview that's expressed in a film that's meant to represent a time and place. I mean, people were less tolerant of homosexuality back then, and I don't think you can gloss over that either, you know?
Yeah, I was just going to say, similarly, it made me uncomfortable as like a 21st century viewer, and in the same ways that all the misogyny made me uncomfortable. And I don't think it excuses it, but I also recognize that, you know, it was, these people are existing in a different era, and they have a point of view that I don't have to agree with and whatnot. And you're just sort of observing them doing whatever they do. But I did. Yeah. I found this, I was able to sort of like, exactly like Zachy said, I was able to sort of understand the era and, you know, how people felt back then and whatnot. But I did find myself cringing a lot. We already brought it up, but a lot of the ways that women are treated and talked to, again, I mean, you know, slapping a woman on her butt or something is one thing that's still not all right, but it's something you sort of would recognize from a Mad Men era or even earlier. But I remember there was one part during a surgery too, where someone was like, get your tits out of the way or something like that, or something about like, and then I can't remember if this is the same moment, but a nurse does something and she yelled at specifically, you know, in a sexist sort of way. And then she does something well, and then they sort of like compliment her, mm-hmm. but like still in the context of like, well, you're lucky this because you're still kind of an idiot or something. And I was like, ugh. Like, it made me uncomfortable. But again, that's what this movie is. Like, and that's why I had to take a step back and sort of be like, I don't have to necessarily like these people or even feel like I would ever want to be friends with these people. But it's an observation of a group of people existing in this weird situation. And I appreciate the artistry of it, I guess, that was what I ultimately walked away with from this movie. So I don't know if that makes any sense with what you were just saying, but
no, I understand. I think it could be that the reason people aren't bothered by the misogyny or the racism in Mad Men is because that show was made now, and you're not at all believing that the show is advocating those points of views.
That's a great point. Yeah. That's a great point.
Yeah, the show is clearly saying, look how ridiculous this was. But you look at MASH and you're like, well, maybe they kind of were. You just don't know because it's 1970. It's right.
Like, do they want this to be funny to you?
Right.
Yeah.
And I guess, like I said, when the Painless Paul, as they call him, you know, says he's going to kill himself, everyone just completely mocks him, sort of sarcastically. And I love the scene where he's in the coffin after he's taken the poison pill, and they start, like, one point, I think it's Hawkeye, can't even barely contain his laughter at this whole notion. Even though to the dentist, he's going to die, the dentist doesn't know that it's not a real poison pill. And then at one point, like, Boone comes by, and he says, I think you're throwing away your whole education, you know? Like, he's like, those are not the final words you would give to somebody.
And somebody else it's like a whole Last Supper sort of scene. So it's like the movie is sort of smirking through this moment. Actually, I was more disturbed by the later when he was asleep and the one woman, you know, who is it? Who's the guy? I can't remember who does it.
Hawkeye gets Lieutenant Dish, played by Joanne Flew.
Yes. I couldn't remember if it was Hawkeye.
Cure him of his erectile dysfunction by having sex with him, which is...
Because she wants to have sex with Hawkeye, and he's just like, no, this is what you're going to do tonight. And she doesn't want to.
Right.
And I was like, ugh.
Yeah.
You know? And she's like, fine. And just kind of.
But then she does go along with it, though.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a little unnerving to me, but.
Yeah, they really did need to sand down all those edges when they came to the TV show. I mean, they really just couldn't do that kind of raw, you know? I mean, on the TV show, they did do the whole plot of broadcasting Burns and Hot Lips in an intimate moment to the camp. They just weren't having sex. In the show, they're just sort of making lovey talk as opposed to in the movie where they're literally literally having sex with one another. So they had to sand down all those edges. So this movie really just kind of rolls along. It to me, it still feels very fresh. It still is very entertaining. It just serves as, to me, and because I've read comic books my whole life, just I look at this as this is like an alternate Earth version of the 4077 that I know. Yeah, this is the Earth 2 version of the 4077. This is not the version that I want to read. I was about to say Freudian slip read, because I've read the original MASH novel, and it's even worse than the movie. I mean, the characters are even meaner and more racist. And, you know, so to me, I'm like, these characters might be called Hawkeye and Trapper, but these are... those are not the versions that I want to live with. So I'm perfectly happy living with the one I'm familiar with. So it's like, okay. And the guy that wrote the book, Richard Hooker, he didn't like the show either. I mean, I don't know why, considering it probably made him a very wealthy man, but he was actually, not only did he not like the show, he was vociferously public about not liking the show, to the point where Larry Gelbart actually, who of course created the MASH TV show, dings Richard Hooker on the show in the episode The Interview, where they all interview everybody. And Frank Burns has a line where he says, I might get out of politics and write a book about my experiences. And that was Larry Gelbart's little shot at Richard Hooker, because Richard Hooker was
funny.
This sort of conservative Republican and didn't like MASH and thought it was liberal crap and all this stuff. So it was Larry Gelbart was kind of getting his little shot in.
It sort of reminds me of how Tom Clancy did not like the movie adaptations of his books, at least the two Harrison Ford ones, and how coming from the same perspective, you know, because he was politically a little bit more conservative, and the films were probably a little bit more left leaning, you know, kind of the same thing. And Harrison Ford would be very, you know, in his very professional but a judgmental way, be like, well, Mr. Clancy is free to like what he likes, you know, like, it's just...
The check's cash either way.
Wait, wait. How would Harrison say that, Zeki? And then Entertainment Tonight is like salty words from Harrison Ford.
I really hope my mic picked that up, Zaki, so you could hear your Harrison Ford impression. That's fantastic. Yeah, I mean, the very last thing that I sort of want to mention of this movie is that in the very final moments, the damn thing breaks the fourth wall. And you have you have the announcer thanking you for watching the movie MASH.
And then there's no end credits.
No, they just everybody gets a screenshot where they go through all the names, you know, Tamela Horrocks and Bud Cort and G. Wood and blah, blah, blah. And then they just go, that is all. And that's the end of the movie. They're like, okay, enjoy the Vietnam War, folks. You know, it's like, that's it. It's the end of the movie.
Yeah, I loved that. I thought that was great.
It's an amazing cool way to end your movie. To just have somebody basically come on stage and say, thanks for coming and watching our movie. You know, it's like, okay.
Yeah. Congrats. Definitely kept in the spirit of what. Yeah.
I think it's a terrific movie. It deserves all of its plaudits. I think it's on the AFI's top 100 movies of all time. It's 20th Century Fox always puts out reissues of it. It's just like a constant moneymaker for them. I think it's just a great, great movie. It's just, if you are the lover of the show, it's just very different. It's just a very different set of experiences. But, you know, if you can set that aside, as you were, Brian, you were able to do that, just enjoy it on its own merits. Because it's Altman was so ahead of his time. This movie, to me, still seems very fresh, very new. It holds up. And that's, you know, you can't say that for a lot of movies that are 45 years old at this
point. Yeah, yeah. No, it still feels, this is such the wrong word, but sort of like provocative or... It stirs up emotions in you, you know, where sometimes you laugh along with everyone and sometimes you're like, I hate these people. but at the same time, I couldn't stop thinking about it. And I definitely was thankful that I watched it. And I think it's for people who can enjoy something like this and want to think about something like this, I definitely think it's worth a look.
Zaki, you agree?
I'm right there with Brian.
All right. Well, the very last bit of trivia I have, and this is kind of a downer note, but I have it in my notes and I'll use it, is the actor who played Henry Blake in this movie, Roger Bowen.
Yeah, I know what you're going to say.
Yeah, Roger Bowen. And then, of course, the actor who played Henry Blake on the TV show, McLean Stevenson, died one day apart. That is very odd. I remembered hearing it. But McLean Stevenson died first. And he was the first.
And I read that, what's the film actor's name?
Roger Bowen.
Roger Bowen, yeah. His family held the announcement for like a week or two because they didn't want people to think that it was just about McLean Stevenson.
Oh, wow. Oh, that's weird.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, what are the odds of that, right? I mean,
I remembered hearing about McLean Stevenson was the first MASH cast member to die. And that was a big deal to me because I was really, I was like, oh, wow. And, you know, and then the very next day they said, oh, Roger Bowen, who played Henry Blake. I was like, what? You know, like, what are the odds of that? It was very, very strange.
Yeah.
And, I guess the very last bit of MASH trivia that I will mention in case I never do my MASH show is one time I was on the streets of New York and I'm walking. This is in 1993-94. And I'm walking up 8th Avenue, and there's this gentleman in front of me, and I'm walking, and all of a sudden the guy stops short, turns, and I look, and it's Larry Linville.
No way.
And I was like, oh my God, that's Frank Burns. And he looked kind of, for a second, like he didn't know where to go, and then he figured out, oh, I guess I got to go down here, and he made a sharp left turn, and I just was so stunned that it was Larry Linville, that I didn't chase him down and say anything. And I wish to God I had, because A, Larry Linville's no longer with us, so I'll never get that opportunity. And I have to think that in 1993, Larry Linville probably would have been really appreciative that a 20-something-year-old knew who he was.
Sure,
right.
You know? I mean, he had been off MASH for decades, and I was, you know, I was a weird kid that in 23, I'm like obsessed with MASH, but I would have just been like, can I take you to lunch? You know, here, like, awesome, dude.
Right around then, he was on an episode of Lois and Clark. I don't know if you ever.
Really? Oh yeah, I don't remember that one, but yeah, I did watch.
Yeah, it's a first season episode called "I'm Seeing Through You." I think it's called. It's about the Invisible Man, and he has a sort of an extended cameo.
Oh, that's good. I'm glad that he kept busy, and I hope that MASH, you know, I hope he kept living off MASH money for the 5 seasons that he did it. So. So anyway, yeah, MASH the movie. If anybody listening to this hasn't seen it, check it out. It is an amazing, amazing film. I wouldn't watch it back to back with Patton, but I would watch it. would watch it anyway. So I guess we're gonna wrap it up here, guys. Thank you so much for doing this. I was so excited when you guys were talking about MASH on movie film that I just was like, well, this was great. And then I was like, well, you know what? Let me email the guys and see if they want to do it. And this is just so thrilling. I love movie film. I love your commentaries. I'm just like a super fan. And so I'm really honored that you could both be on the show at the same time.
Well, it's weird for me and Brian to be doing something else. Like it feels like when Siskel and Ebert would show up on Letterman.
I can take that. I'll take that comparison. I can live with it.
That's funny.
So tell people, there's nobody here that listens to my show that doesn't listen to movie film, but tell everybody about where they can find movie film.
Brian, I'm going to let you do it this time.
Oh, no. This is honestly...
Do you want me to do it?
Here's a peek behind the curtain. I totally, like, start making notes and writing things, and I hardly ever listen to Zachy's call off at the end. So, well, I will say this. You can go to moviefilmpodcast.com. You can find us there, of course, at facebook.com/moviefilmpodcast. And we are, let's see, we're on iTunes, Stitcher, Blog Talk Radio. Am I missing something?
Google Play, TuneIn Radio, you name it, basically. Wherever you find podcasts, you'll find
us. Yeah, pretty easy to find. Just Google Movie Film Podcast, Movie Film, one word, and you'll be able to find us.
All right. And because these guys are not going to do it, I'll wax their car a little bit more. They do, or their Jeep, I should say. They do a bunch of really great audio commentaries, full-length audio commentaries for different movies. And those are just so much fun to listen to. And
oh, wow. Thank you so much.
Yeah. I should there are certain podcasts I listen to when I do my morning run. And some are not great to listen to, some shows, but you guys – always do like really great shows. And not to reveal when we're recording this, but when we're recording this, I have not yet seen Spider-Man Homecoming. You guys have done your Spider-Man Homecoming episode, and so I will be seeing it today. So I am saving your episode for my morning run tomorrow. That's what I'm going to be listening to on my 4:30 a.m. run is your Spider-Man Homecoming episode. So.
Oh man, that really means a lot. Thank you very much.
Yeah, hope we can make that run a little bit more pleasant.
I will. Yeah, I'm sure you will. You guys do great. The commentaries are outstanding. So they're really, really fun show. So everybody, thanks so much for coming on. If everybody wants to hear back episodes of our show, of course, it's on our network site, which is fireandwaterpodcast.com. And you can follow us on Twitter, which is @filmandwaterpod. So again, guys, thanks so much for coming on. And we will see everybody next week. And until then, that's a wrap.
Attention. Tonight's movie has been MASH. Follow the zany antics of our combat surgeons as they cut and stitch their way along the front lines. Operating as bombs and bullets burst around them, snatching laughs and love between amputations and penicillin.
Did Hawkeye steal that Jeep?
No, sir, that's the one he came in.
Oh, very good. Come along, my dear.
Follow Hawkeye, Trapper, Duke, Dago Red, Painless, Radar, Hot Lips, Dish, and Staff Sergeant Vollmer as they put our boys back together again. Starring Donald Sutherland, Elliot Gould, Tom Skerritt, Sally Kellerman, Robert Duvall, Joanne Flug, Rene Aubergenois, Roger Bowen, Gary Berghoff, David Arkin, John Chuck, Fred Williams, and Indus Arthur, Tim Brown, Corey Fisher, Bud Cort, Carl Gottlieb, Don Damon, Tamara Horrocks, Ken Primus, Danny Goldman, Kim Atwood, Michael Murphy, G. Wood, Rick Nealon, and Bobby Troop.
Goddamn army.
That is all.
Salty words from Harrison Ford.